This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
The Albanese government has today released the rules of Australia's world-first social media ban for children under 16. From the 10th of December, platforms will be required to take reasonable steps to remove the accounts of under 16-year-olds and prevent them from re-registering. But they won't be required to verify the ages of all users or implement specific verification technologies.
Social media bans for younger users have begun to take hold in various countries, particularly in Europe. In Canada, Bill S-209 may ostensibly be about underage access to pornography sites, but the bill's proponents seem positively giddy at the prospect of a more broad application to social media. The start of this trend began in Australia, which passed what is called a social media ban for underage youth in late 2024, with the law taking effect just a couple of months ago. Lisa Given is a Canadian-Australian information studies academic who is currently the Distinguished Professor of Information Studies at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, or RMIT, in Melbourne, Australia. She's been closely tracking and commenting on the Australian legislation, and she joins me on the podcast to discuss its origins, how the law functions, the concerns it's raised, and what lessons Canada might draw from the experience to date. Lisa, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for joining. You know, social media bans for underage users has definitely been catching on. I think Australia, it's fair to say, was at the forefront of the issue, but we've seen it spread to a number of countries in Europe, France and Spain, among others. And we're seeing more and more discussion, I think, now in Canada, with some considering something similar, either as directly dealing with social media or through some other legislation that I've talked on the podcast, dealing with pornography sites. And certainly some of the advocates of that bill thinking about the prospect of extending it to other sites that might include social media sites. But all of this raises the question, you know, is this good policy? Does it represent in some ways a failure of regulating and regulating these services? And does it work at all? I'm glad you've joined me on the podcast to help sort through some of these questions. And you've been pretty outspoken in talking about the Australian experience and some of its implications. So why don't we start there? Can you give a bit of an explanation as to the Australian law, you know, where it begins, what are some of the restrictions that they've put into place?
Sure. So the legislation was passed late in 2024 and came into effect in December 2025. And even though the headlines, I think, all throughout this period have really said social media ban, that's really what's gotten those headlines internationally. The scope of the legislation is actually very, very specific and much more narrow than I think the average person imagines. So what the legislation does is it actually restricts kids under the age of 16 from having an account on what are classified as age-restricted social media platforms. So the legislation didn't come out and list those platforms. It basically gave this definition. And all of the platforms that exist in the world are meant to do a self-assessment to see if they fall under the legislation. If they do, then what they have to do is effectively block kids from having accounts. Now, immediately following this, parents, everyone, kids start saying, wait a minute, how do we define social media? What does that mean exactly? And so over time, ahead of the legislation coming into effect, the eSafety Commissioner here started sending letters to different companies, flagging that they were likely to be falling under the legislation. And we ended up with an initial list, as they called it, of the typical players you might expect. TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, things that are very kind of household names. And the government effectively said, we're starting with ones where we know we have a large youth footprint. It didn't mean that other things weren't captured, but it also included a number of exemptions. And so I think that's also where we get into interesting territory, because gaming apps, messaging apps are excluded, as well as things that are primarily health related or education related.
Okay. Wow. I mean, that raises a whole series of questions sort of right off the top that I want to get into. You know, that process for determining who was in and who was out. So I think you suggested there that it's the eSafety Commissioner that that made those decisions. Is that right? And what was the process that was involved to make some of these calls, to make the kinds of decisions about who was included and who was excluded?
Exactly. Well, the legislation itself included some definitions. And so the eSafety Commissioner is effectively in charge of enacting this and bringing it to the fore. And so the definitions are really what get us tied into some knots, because the critical aspect there is they define it really as a platform that its sole or primary purpose is that kind of social networking and engagement. And so this is where the devil lies in the details, because many of our platforms these days are very, multifaceted. And so when you look at an example of Roblox, which lots of people know, it has, 380 million users worldwide. You might argue, okay, that looks to us like a gaming platform. Or you could argue maybe it's an educational platform. Now, they received a letter initially and they were really kind of pushing back and saying, wait a minute, we don't think we actually fall under this definition. We've actually seen that also with Reddit, for example. Now, they've decided that they're on the list, they're going to comply, but they've actually launched a lawsuit because they don't believe that they actually meet the definition.
Okay, and I'd like to get back to that Reddit lawsuit in a moment, because I understand that's one of the sort of the lead cases that at least is challenging some of this process. What kind of debate took place around all of this? If I think of some of the Canadian experience around this stuff, it tends to be, think of the children, and everybody wants to ensure, of course, that kids are safe online, which at times can make it difficult to get into a true policy-oriented debate, because if you are against some of this legislation, you run the risk of being accused of not being concerned about kids' safety. Is that how the debate played out in Australia as well?
It's interesting. It really evolved over time. So when this first was mooted, it came out of South Australia. The Premier of South Australia basically said, hey, we're going to bring in this legislation. And then the federal government decided, wait a minute, maybe this is something we should look at nationally. And that took off after that. But when in the early days, when you listen to what the Prime Minister was saying, part of it was, we need to deal with online harm. I think everyone, all experts agree that there's harmful content. Kids do need to be protected. The question became, how do we best do that? But there were also people, both in the news and also the Prime Minister himself saying, oh, kids are spending too much time on devices. We want to get them out. They should be playing footy. They should be enjoying time outside with their friends. So even those early days, there were a lot of mixed messages. And when you listen to parents on call-in radio, for example, it was a real mixture of people worrying about cyberbullying and wanting that to be dealt with, people worrying about screen time, people worrying about deepfake pornography. So everything kind of got put into this big mess. And I think a lot of people definitely came out saying they were behind the ban, quote unquote, without fully understanding the limits of the legislation or even the limits of technology that was going to be needed in order to enact something like this. So I think that the main messaging was around protecting children, dealing with harm, trying to deal with the influence of tech companies. That also extends to things like algorithms, advertising. So it was a really mixed bag of problems and issues. But at the end of the day, the legislation itself is actually quite narrow in its focus.
Yeah, interesting. So, and I'm assuming that the large companies you already mentioned, that Reddit is challenging in this in the courts, and you've got Roblox, you said, sort of pushed back on some of the initial thinking. I'm assuming as this process unfolded, you had some of the larger players, even those that would quite clearly be captured by this, seek to push back. So, what were they arguing? Were they arguing that there were other mechanisms to address some of these kinds of safety concerns? They talk about enforceability or some of the other risks. Where did their messaging lie?
Sure. So YouTube's an interesting example. I mean, they're basically arguing that they are, that they deliver videos. Like, this is what that they do on their platform, and that any kind of social component is kind of incidental. Now, the interesting thing about YouTube, of course, is that you don't need an account to watch the content. So we all thought that maybe YouTube would be the first out of the gate with a lawsuit because they were quite vocal in those early days. They've not progressed with that. But at the end of the day, are the users still going to be there? Likely yes, because kids can still go onto a browser and do that. We also saw at the same time a company like Instagram, for example, that's owned by Meta, they were creating, you know, teen-friendly accounts, and their plans were to move all kids over to their teen-friendly accounts, which have a lot of even parental controls, and it gave parents some say in what a kid could do on that platform. But under the legislation, that type of an approach does not meet the goals of the legislation. And so that wasn't going to be kind of an out or a success story for that type of platform. What's interesting about the legislation, I think, from the big tech perspective, is that all that it requires is not for the companies to keep 100% of kids from having an account. It's to demonstrate they've taken reasonable steps to do so. And so that's really going to be really critical and likely something that would play out in the courts if the eSafety Commissioner decides to fine companies for non-compliance. But I think at the end of the day, you know, very early on, the government said, look, you can't just have a tick box saying, yes, I'm over 16. That's not going to meet the definition of a reasonable step. That's why they've now put in age assurance, user behavior, estimation checks. Do those meet the definition? Potentially. We're really not clear yet on whether the government thinks that, you know, what the companies have done actually meets their goals.
Okay, that begs the question, what are they doing? You know, as I mentioned or alluded to, the debate in Canada around the pornography legislation has talked specifically around age verification and age estimation technologies. Is that what you're seeing these companies do for users? Does it apply to all users, or are there other mechanisms that they're seeking to use to find a way to comply?
At the end of the day, it really applies to all Australians. And I think this also caught a lot of adults off guard because for, you know, a lot of people looking at the media, they think, oh, it's about the kids, it's not about me, or I don't have children, so I'm not worried. But at the end of the day, the companies have to decide how, you know, of the millions of us, who's under 16, who's over 16. The first deep plan that happened, the thing that they enacted, was really quite quiet. They're allowed to look at all of the data they already have and they know about you. And if they can then reasonably guess that you're over the age of 16, well, that's fine. So, for example, if I have a Facebook account for 20 years, that's likely that that account is held by someone over the age of 16. So there is no further measure needed. They were then able to triage down and start looking at the accounts where they weren't sure about someone's age. So, in a lot of this debate time, for example, in the country, you probably had a lot of kids that were signing onto accounts and going, hey, I'm 35 years old. On those accounts, what the companies did is implement additional checks. So, facial scanning was the primary one. Now, that's not facial recognition. It's not comparing, you know, something against a database of your known identity. It really is looking at people, the markers, you know, what are people's faces looking like, and looking at those traditional markers of age as best as they can do, which gives an error rate about 1 to 3 years. So that's not, you know, a perfect measure by any stretch. There were some that actually attempted to link to other tokens, for example. So can we do something through a banking system where the bank knows what your age is? Can we do a token system so that the bank actually gives back an assurance of what your age is? So there were a variety of measures, but for the most part, it was user data. Some of it was around facial scanning. And then, of course, they can also use user behavior checks. So, what are the accounts that you follow? What do you typically like on these platforms? And making a best guess as to whether, on balance, that looks like a child or an adult.
Okay. So the privacy alarm bells are just ringing loudly as you walk through all of those different measures. It sounds basically like surveil your customers and dig into their data as much as you can to try to piece together how old you think they happen to be. And if you're not totally sure or you feel that you can't necessarily meet the standards, then ask for more data in terms of some of the age estimation and the like. Does
Correct. And interestingly, the government, when this was being debated, now it was only debated in Parliament for 24 hours. We did not have enough time exactly. The experts in the country were very concerned. There was kind of very little time to actually engage in formal debate. But one of the amendments that was put in the floor at that time was that companies could not only ask for government-issued ID. And so the legislation required then the companies to be using these other measures. They could not just say, upload a copy of your driver's license, but they can do that if those initial checks have failed. So we had a number of people here, for example, over the age of 16. The age assurance system did not work, and then they were required to upload their driver's license. So obviously, and we've had, lots of data breaches in the country, big companies. So privacy and data breaches and concerns about identity theft are very front of mind. And that's also raised a number of concerns for everyday consumers about, do we want big tech? Should they have access to this kind of data?
Okay, so I mean that it's just shocking to hear that the lack of debate and discussion that took place, as well as even some of the measures that are being considered, given that the legislation is only a couple of months old. How have people been reacting to it? How are some of the teenagers that might get directly caught in this, or even those that may not be teenagers, but for whatever reason, some of their markers are such that the companies are unsure as to how old they happen to be, and suddenly find themselves having to provide identification to access lawful services.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this launched right at the height of, school holidays just started. We're in the summer period here. So a lot of kids were already heading off with family to the beach, et cetera. That may be a time where they're less likely to be on some of these platforms. But some of the kids were saying, look, I'm happy to be off of these. I don't have to kind of perform in front of the camera on my social media feeds anymore. But many, if not the vast majority of kids were saying, look, I've lost my community. We've actually had to jump to other platforms. So immediately we saw kids going to platforms that parents and general public had never heard of, things like Yope and Red Note, for example. Now, in enterprising kids, this is what they do. They find other platforms. So we saw big spikes happening with that. But we also saw them quite surprised that many of them actually weren't checked at all. So many of them, whatever the data was in the background, they didn't even get a request. Some of them did do the facial scanning and sailed through. A number of them played with, can I dress up my face differently? Can I put on a mask? And were able to get through. Some were blocked and then created another account on the same platform the next day and got through. So it's very much a mixed bag. And of course, as I mentioned, we've also had adults over 16 who were blocked, and many of them were quite frustrated that, they were off of these platforms for several days, especially people who run their own businesses. And we do have young people who are running their own businesses on social media.
Right. And so, I mean, that's just such a grab bag of different responses and approaches. How is this enforced? I mean, you mentioned the eSafety Commissioner. Is there any enforcement yet? Can it be enforced in your view?
Yeah, so in the initial stages, she has made it clear that the companies are expected to report on a regular basis, whether that's monthly or every few weeks. I'm not really sure of the rhythm of that, but we had initial reports that came out. So Meta was the first out of the gate to say, look, we've removed, about 500,000 accounts. On balance now, we've heard they've removed about 4.7 million accounts. But keeping in mind, that doesn't equate to people because many people have multiple accounts. And we also don't know how many of those were taken down and then a child, say, starting a new account the very next day. So I think we're going to be in for quite a number of months of this period of reporting. The eSafety Commissioner and the government are well aware of workarounds in terms of not just the challenges with age assurance and the limits of those tech, but also things like using VPNs to get around and pretend that you're not here in Australia. They've said, look, we want the tech companies to tighten the reins, and we're going to be scrutinizing and looking at the percentage of accounts that they're removing. I think there's going to come a push point where the government has to reconcile. Have they met that measure of reasonable steps or not? Is that going to be a moving feast for the tech companies in terms of what the government expects? Absolutely unclear. And I expect that if fines are given, because there are meant to be fines in the multi-millions of dollars for non-compliance, then we're likely going to see a number of lawsuits. But it may well be that many companies are biding their time as the Reddit lawsuit starts to come through, and they'll see what happens with that.
Okay, so there is the prospect of very significant penalties for non-compliance, but we're just not there yet. We are there with the Reddit lawsuit. So can you unpack that a little bit? I think you suggested that they are complying but challenging at the same time. Can you explain a little bit how they've approached the legislation?
Sure. So they came out and basically decided that they would comply in the short term while a lawsuit went through the courts, which is interesting. They could have just decided that no, we're just going to keep things the way that they are and kind of call the government's bluff as you would. But they've decided to go that route. Now, I guess part of this will be how closely they can align themselves to the exclusions within the legislation. So I think, many people use Reddit as a source of information. They certainly position themselves that way. They don't believe that they are the same in terms of the approach of other platforms or the design of other platforms, and particularly around the algorithmic nature and the harms that come from the algorithms. So I think they're going to be putting forward, some interesting arguments there. Could they argue that they're an educational platform? Perhaps. At the same time, of course, we know that some Reddit threads do contain harmful content, would not be considered safe for kids. And so it's really a question of how are they going to navigate whether or not they fall into the legislation? And at least if they're found to need to comply, if they are determined through that through the courts that they are age restrictive, then they've already been complying from day one.
Right, that's true. Now, in the case of Reddit, and you mentioned YouTube earlier as well, I mean, those are both examples of wildly popular services that don't require accounts. I mean, people are able
That's
to
right.
use and scan. So, does this change things in Australia? Do the companies now require you to have an account to access the service, or this is just one giant loophole where it only applies if you get an account, but you're not required to have one in order to meet the legislation?
Yeah.
Seems a bit ineffective if you could still access these services, just not bother with an account.
Absolutely. And that's the largest loophole here that we've been talking about over the past 18 months. The companies are not required to put controls in place in that way. Now, of course, Australia is also bringing in additional pieces of regulation. About 9 different pieces of regulation over late 2025 and into early 2026. And I suspect that a lot of this is there are other kind of other bits of machinery happening behind the scenes that are going to deal with some of the harmful content anyway. So they may decide that, and they've said it's not perfect, it's a starting point, and it's pushing the tech companies to effect change. We will see what that really means in reality. But if you look, for example, in December of 2025, they launched regulations around accounts on search engines. Now, this is an interesting one where they're trying to determine anyone that's over or under the age of 18. And this one is meant to actually keep kids from stumbling upon extreme violence content, pornography, self-harm material. And again, it's at the account level. So many of us are signed in all the time to our Google accounts, and Google is the big one in Australia. But what this effectively means is if someone is signed in under the age of 18 and they search for the word pornography, nothing will be delivered back to them. The companies are required to basically not deliver results on anything deemed extreme violence, self-harm, or porn. And they have to provide additional information. So if someone searches for information about self-harm, the system is meant to deliver helpful information, hotlines, and things like that. Now, again, what does that mean? It likely means that people will do more searching without being logged in. If you're not logged in, the companies are required to blur imagery, so little thumbnails of pornographic imagery, but kids can still link through to the content.
Okay, interesting. I mean, so you start seeing workarounds, some of which are very easy, whether that's just not using an account to access some of these services, or VPN use, or of course trying to find ways to get an account. Speaking of which, is there any role for parents in all of this? You know, in many much of the debate around some of these questions often comes down to, well, there's a parental role. And especially as you start, as these kids start getting older, I mean, 15 and 16 year olds, of course, are still legally kids. But at the same time, in many instances, these services are a big part of their lives. It's a big part of being a cohort and parent. And there may well be many parents that say, yeah, no, I'm pretty comfortable with my kid using these services. Does that factor in at all, or it's the government here making a decision saying, well, it doesn't matter what the parents want, we're establishing these rules and they apply to everyone?
Absolutely. So there has been a real kind of hue and cry from parents here in Australia on those exact grounds, particularly for older teens, as you say. And many parents have said, look, kids do mature at different rates, but some of these kids do have businesses that they run on social media platforms with the support of their parents and with parent involvement. So when parents realize that they wouldn't have a say, that has actually been a significant issue. And we're actually seeing now that there are many parents that are actually sitting down doing the facial scan for their kids to keep them on those platforms. The government's been really clear there will be no fines or it's not a problem. No one is going to be penalized if you're an adult or a child and you're still found to be on these platforms. They're trying to hold the tech companies to account. But what you see in other countries, I've been really interested. You look at Denmark, you look at Spain, that's recently announced. All of those typically do have a parental opt-out in the legislation. So other countries are actually trying to empower parents a little more and say, look, this is the default. And that's certainly the way even Instagram's teen accounts are set up. The expectation is the default has top level, privacy and security controls. If parents want to walk that back, then that's up to them. That's not something that's technically available here in Australia.
Okay, interesting. Well, why don't we wrap with this, as with that caveat again, it's only 2 months, and so it's going to take some time to unfold, whether in the courts or otherwise. What lessons so far are there for Canada or for other jurisdictions that are thinking about this stuff? I mean, it sounds like we're starting to, in some ways, almost more emphasis on workarounds than compliance. So I guess your view, does this work? And whether it does or doesn't, what's the right way about going about pulling this together? Because certainly the data point that you raised early on about 24 hours of debate is pretty stunning given the kind of implications that this sort of legislation has.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, I it doesn't work. It technically can't work. My bigger concern is that kids that are blocked, particularly in regional and rural areas where they have no access to other services, or they may be in a household that is not supportive enough of their needs, have now really been blocked from an important source of information. We don't have additional resources coming in to fill that gap, and that would actually be really difficult. But I think, what I've been really looking at over more than a year now is really the need for digital duty of care legislation. Now, this is something that was put forward exactly at the same time as the social media legislation in Australia, but then it got put on the side and social media became the thing that went through. Now, interestingly, the government has actually revived that. They've done public consultation in December of last year. So I think they're going to bring this in this year. And what that legislation does is really hold the tech companies to account. It really deals with algorithms, advertising. It has takedown measures for inappropriate content. It also has big hefty fines. But more importantly, it's very similar to the legislation in the EU and in the United Kingdom. And so I really think that the lesson to be learned here is that the social media type ban is not a ban. It becomes a bit of a distraction that really doesn't get to the heart of the issue, which is that the tech companies are not doing enough to keep these platforms safe for everyone. And I really believe that if companies can band together and actually enact similar digital duty of care legislation, that's a powerful market base that could actually push the tech companies to make real change.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's interesting because we also had online harms legislation. It didn't pass, although it's expected to return. And it was premised on a duty to act responsibly, which sounds roughly similar to the kind of duties that you're describing. And it feels like in some ways, it's interesting that you had those two paths sort of moving in the same way at one point in time, and they kind of hopped off and went, at least initially now, with the social media ban, because it really feels like the ban is a failure to regulate as opposed to an attempt to try to come up with effective regulation. I mean, the duty to act responsibly or a duty of care basically says you can operate, but we're going to find mechanisms to hold you to account, to ensure that you act in a responsible, appropriate fashion and set some guardrails around all of that. Whereas a ban is just saying, almost just throwing your hands up and saying, well, we don't really know what to do, so we're just going to block people from accessing your service altogether. And it sounds as if Australia was thinking about both, and then in an over a 24-hour debate said, ah, forget the much more difficult realm of finding ways to balance freedom of expression with real safety, and instead let's just block some people from accessing the service altogether.
Absolutely. And it's interesting if you listen to the government, back at that time, it was as though they really believed that this could be done 100% and that it would somehow be easy to regulate and to do. And they've really walked themselves back. If you look at the lead up the month before the legislation went forward, they had completely reversed themselves. It was not really a ban, it was just a delay. There's multiple ways, other legislation we have to introduce. Hence, here comes digital duty of care. But it's interesting because, of course, what you're doing with the social media ban is you're effectively kind of penalizing consumers, young consumers, and you're also making it such that kids who are particularly tech savvy or have additional resources at hand are perhaps not even going to be affected by this legislation, right? They're still on the platforms, they've found workarounds. It's really often, the kids that are most vulnerable that may not have those other supports or mechanisms, and maybe, in families where they're not tech savvy enough to work around it.
Okay. I mean it's not surprising to hear that, but to when you lay it out that way, it really does provide, I think, a valuable caution in many ways for other jurisdictions, including Canada. We went through some of the same sorts of debates as to is whether or not Australia is a model, whether it was on the media legislation or some other forms of legislation. And there were those that saying, well, Australia provides a really good roadmap. And in some ways, some of those that legislation didn't translate well in Canada. And it sounds like there's some real risks here as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for unpacking what's taking place. That I think it's a word of warning that is really needed here because, as I say, there's a bit of a freight train that's moving toward this kind of legislation. It's good to hear your experience with a jurisdiction that's now at least a couple months in testing it out.
Yeah, and I think the key thing for me is always that parents here often then have a real false sense of security. I think that the social media ban legislation, it makes the headlines, it makes people feel comfortable, but thank God the government's doing something. But when you look underneath the hood, it really isn't going to achieve what people want it to achieve. And that does really actually take much different and more challenging legislation.
Well, thanks for that. A really good warning. And thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod, or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca, or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.